committees on behalf of our National Association of Insurance Commissioners, and one of the Finance Committee, I think the time I met with them, and that was in July of 2009, Alice, you might have even been on that panel. We shared the panel a couple of times. I suggested that at that time they were looking at 4-to-1, and our National Association suggested maybe they should think about a little wider age band, at least initially, and then gradually phase it down so that we didn't price younger, healthier folks out of the market. So they were looking at 4-to-1, they ended up at 3-to-1, so I like to tell people I didn't do a very good job, obviously, of explaining that, because they didn't, they went the other direction. And that, you know, I think has a lot of us at the state level worried. States got to select their geographic rating areas. We're getting a little bit of pushback from some of the companies at the state level wanting to deviate a little bit from that, but the law is very clear. State, once those great geographic rating areas are set, the companies do need to comply with them. Other rating factors, it's been interesting, you've probably heard, the tobacco use, even the Cancer Society has come out and said, you know, maybe we don't want to charge people that smoke more, because really those are people that maybe are most likely to need health services, and you want them to buy coverage. So states do have the option to, instead of doing the 1.5 for tobacco use, if they want to just use a equal rating factor for, and not even have tobacco use as one of the factors. And really, honestly, I think it'll be a nightmare to try to police. I don't even want to think about how we might, I guess it'll be on the honor system, like Uber was talking earlier about letting self-reporting. We mentioned in the last slide that the individual businesses can be pooled into one pool, and all the small group business into one pool. Grandfather plans are exempt initially, but I think gradually over time, even those grandfather plans will come into one of those two pools, either individual or the small group pool. And the rate for younger, healthier enrollees, the rate shock there, I think, is the thing that we probably worry about the most. There are things that states can do, and certainly through our National Association of Insurance Commissioners, we've been looking at ways of providing guidance to the states. So we know that for the first 3 years, there's a reinsurance pool that will help a fund that will go to the states to help offset the expense of bringing those high-risk pool individuals into the individual market. And so that will have, at least for the first few years, I think, will help offset some of the rate shock. There are risk corridors and risk adjustments. So risk corridors will help stabilize rates in these qualified health plans, and then the risk adjustment is a program that going forward will work across the entire risk pool. And that means that if you are a plan that gets a higher than the average risk, you'll get some financial assistance that is paid into a central pool from the plans that have less than the average risk. And so it sort of gives us some way of leveling that playing field, and it's certainly not community rating, but it helps accomplish the same thing that a community rating system would do. Medical loss ratio was a lot of angst about that when it was first put in place. It's been in operation now since 2011. NAIC, our national association, was actually charged in the law with coming up with the methodology around medical loss ratio. And we had to determine in the small group market, how do we define healthcare services? 80% of the premium dollar in the small group market has to go towards healthcare services or quality improvement activities. And there was a lot of discussion around quality improvement activities. And just as an example, is a nurse call line a quality improvement activity, or is it an administrative cost? Well, if it's a direct intervention, patient to nurse to enrollee, then that's probably a quality improvement activity. And so as long as the plan justifies how the expenditures around quality improvement are being implemented, then that can be classified as part of that 80%. In the large group market, it's 85-15. And if a company fails to meet the target, then whatever they miss it by, let's say they have 78 instead of 80%, 2% has to go back to each individual enrollee. And probably, if nothing else, it's to the fear of the administrative burden that puts on the company has certainly, I think, caused companies to be very, very careful about how they report their medical cost and how they report their administrative cost. And I think over time, supposedly, and I kind of agree that it's going to help bring about some mitigation of the rate shock. Transparency, of course, all of the there's a lot more transparency in terms of will be once the exchanges are up and running. Federal exchanges, the HHS has said they're not going to publish any rates on the plans going on the federal exchanges until the exchange is up and running in October. Some states are already putting their rates out there. The companies had to get all of their paperwork filed by the end of April. And in fact, let me go to the next. The state's system of regulation through our national association created a system for electronic rate and form filings, a CERF system, system for electronic rate and form filings. States can continue to use that system. Certainly, state exchange states can, and partnership states can, and even states like Kansas, who've indicated we still want to do plan management and consumer assistance, can use that CERF system. NAIC had to do a lot of technical work to bring that system up to standards that would allow these exchanges to use that CERF system. But it really makes it a lot easier. If a state is not using the CERF system, then plans still have to file with the state whatever their plan documents are and their rates, and then they also have to file with the federal system, the Health Information Oversight System, HIOS. So it's a dual process, which is one of the arguments for states that they can to retain the plan management. It eliminates some of the duplication of effort for the states. So the exchange, all of that documentation had to be filed by April 30th of 2013. The reviews have to be completed by the end of July of 2013, and then the exchanges are open for business in October. And again, the state exchanges can run their exchanges. They have their own deadlines that they've imposed. They still need to be ready to go by October 1st, but they may not be conforming to some of those deadlines. Those are for federal exchanges. Or even partnership exchanges. Just briefly, in Kansas, we believe we have enough authority. We've been designated as a state that does have sufficient authority to approve rates. If we didn't, then I think there's some concern that the federal exchange will have to approve the rates in those states that they don't have any rate approval authority. The ultimate weapon, if you will, that a federal exchange has, if they think the rates that a company is charging that wants to go on the exchange are excessive, they can deny access to the exchange for that company. So even though they don't have any rate approval authority in the federal law, they can, in fact, have the ultimate weapon, which is saying you can't be on that federal exchange if we think your rates are excessive. So it's... Again, a lot of questions. We at the state level, we have lots of questions about how all of this is going to be implemented. And we're just trying to hang on to whatever authority we have at the moment. And I just had an interesting email from one of my colleagues who was surprised to find out that one of the insurance regulators that there was no plan going forward after the first few years for federal exchanges because, you know, I think they're, HHS never anticipated that they would be running, the federal law never anticipated that the federal government would be running exchanges. So it shouldn't come as a surprise to any of us that there is no plan going forward. I think the hope still is that states will ultimately take over those exchanges. But to think that somehow HHS should have a process in place already to continue these going forward doesn't make a lot of sense because they ultimately, they have bent over, I will tell you, bent over backwards to try to provide as much flexibility as possible to the states because they do not want to run these marketplaces. Thank you, and I look forward to your questions.
Well, good afternoon. This is the end of the road. We finally get to private health insurance. I was telling Joe Antos at lunch that I was the nominal representative of private health insurance. I thought that was a pretty dubious proposition, that it would be me. But here I am. Those of you who don't know what Emblem Health is, we're the product of the merger between the health insurance plan of Greater New York, or HIP, and group health insurance. When we put it together, we didn't think that GHIP or JIP was a very good name for health insurer, so we decided on Emblem Health. And of course, I should also note for this crowd that really the only reason I'm here is because Stuart is the vice chairman of the board of Emblem Health, and you know, therefore, I had no way to say no, as I suspect you know many of my colleagues probably did. I got a lot of slides. I'm actually going to go through them very quickly, but I found much more interesting this article that I was reading in the New Republic. I know some like Joe will never read this liberal rag, but this was the five scenarios that keep this reporter up at night. Not enough healthy people will sign up. He correctly predicted that the mandate is weak. The computers won't work. More on that in a moment. Rick Perry will seek revenge. But the best one, of course, that I liked was insurance companies will act like insurance companies. He went on to say, it's not exactly comforting that Obamacare may need the good faith of insurers, the one group of health companies that resisted the law all along. I'm not sure that's true. The biggest fear is that insurers will jack up premiums, scaring consumers away. And then he goes on to say that many people working on implementation worry they will simply seize the opportunity to raise premiums regardless of whether it's necessary. So I'm going to get back to that as well. And then the last one was Obama will get smacked no matter what. But the major message I really want to give you today from the perspective of a health insurance company is a sort of, you know, working along, heads down, doing what's required in order to come into compliance with this law. A dirty little secret, the individual and small group market is not our business for the most part. It's a bit of a sideshow. It's very difficult and has always been very difficult to make much money at. And so therefore, insurers have focused on the employer market. And they do this, I think, sort of because they have to, sort of because they always have. And, you know, they will make decisions based upon not risking anything in this sector of the marketplace and will continue to focus on the large employer marketplace where they really have been able to make a more significant profit, or one that is at least sustainable, and on Medicare and on Medicaid. So let me go through this very quickly. This is sort of how we look at it, and you know, we talk about, you know, this is the turbulent period where essentially the rules are changing daily. I can tell you that having filed our proposals to the new New York State Exchange, they are changing the rules after we were filing them, and they were now revising filings based upon that. We expect a huge amount of turbulence in the 2014-16 period. And then presumably after 2016, that's sort of the new normal competition. then, you know, these are the